Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Stack Trace. It's the podcast that's all about life and technology from two developers' perspectives. And those two developers are, like always, me, John Sandel, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Mr. Rambo?
I'm doing great, John. How are you?
I am doing great as well. Are you in a WWDC mood?
Yeah, it's a little bit lower now. I'm slowly fading between dub and normal life. But there's still some of that WWDC vibe in the air.
Yeah, speaking of, I've been thinking about it during like this past week or so, where I feel like the way I personally kind of consume WWDC has really dramatically changed over the years. And part of it is because I am no longer like always tuning into the Apple keynotes. I'm more often these days like either reading a summary or watching a summary afterwards. Checking out what announcements I feel like are the most relevant to me and kind of more like cherry picking what I'm watching. I'm watching a lot of developer videos, but it's less that I feel like I'm going to like take the week off and just like only watch WWDC stuff, and more that I am like during my regular day kind of checking out some of the content. So how's it been for you? Like, are you kind of the same, or are you more kind of immersing yourself in all things WWDC?
I'm still the fanboy, so I still kind of take the week off in a sense to focus on not just learning new stuff, but also getting in touch with other developers and hearing what they have to say about the new things. And by getting in touch, I mean online, at least this year. Like maybe in other years, I could go somewhere, but I do still like that there is this week that the developer community can kind of come together, even if remotely, and just talk about stuff. So I do still kind of take the week off and focus on DubDub. And especially, I really like to watch the keynote. Liked it a lot more when they were truly live events, but they are doing a good job with the videos. And I don't know if you've noticed, but this year they did a bunch of little live things at the Steve Jobs Theater and the Developer Center. One of those videos went live, I think, earlier this week. And if you pay attention, it kind of almost looks like a WWDC keynote for developers, which I know there's the Platform State of the Union. But this one was actually live, and it's so cool to watch a video live. I mean, I didn't watch it live, but they released the recording, and to actually get like the reaction of the audience in the video and things like that. So I really wish they would do more like that. Like maybe if they don't do the keynote live, maybe the Platform State of the Union could be live. And I hope that these live events they did this year are kind of testing, maybe to see if next year they do more of that.
Yeah, because I really feel like there's something lost when the videos are all just pre-recorded. And I understand from like a, you know, pragmatic perspective that that's the right way to go, because then you can edit things, you can also like remove a lot of kind of downtime, or, you know, when people walking on and off stage and stuff like that, right? To really like keep it very tightly edited and as efficient as possible. But there's also, at least for me personally, like when a video is so smooth and so well edited, it kind of makes me like pay attention less, because it's like it almost becomes like too smooth that I kind of start zoning out a little bit. And maybe this doesn't make any sense. Maybe it's just me. But when it's live, I feel like I'm just more engaged. It's almost like, you know, when you go and watch a talk at a conference, you know, at least when I do that, I'm like all into it. Like I'm just like watching the talk and listening to it and just kind of absorbing the information. When I'm watching something like a pre-recorded WWDC video these days, I'm very often kind of distracted, like looking at my phone or something, or maybe let me do some coding here while I'm actually just watching this in the background. And then of course I'm not absorbing the content or the information as well. But again, maybe that's just my personal, like how I relate to these videos. But I feel like as they've gone to these pre-recorded videos, there is no doubt that the kind of quote-unquote quality of the videos is higher, and they're smoother and more professionally, you know, made and edited. But there's just this charm or this thing that kind of caught my attention with the old style, with a live, you know, on stage presentation that I feel like is lost.
Yeah, definitely. I do miss those. I don't think they would ever bring back the full live sessions, because that's logistically, I think doing it pre-recorded is way better for them. Another aspect that probably everyone notices about WWDC session videos is that people speak very slowly, to the point where I'm not that type of person that watches everything at 2x speed, but WWDC videos I can comfortably watch at 2x speed.
Yeah, same.
But I understand why they do that, because they want to make them more accessible to everyone. And you can see that everyone who's presenting has been coached on they should speak slowly. And I think that's awesome. Like, I'm not complaining. There is the speed increase button for that very reason. And Rambo from several years ago, who didn't understand English that well, would be very happy about the pacing. And that's very hard to do live. Like, when you are live, you tend to speak more quickly. At least that's my feeling. So yeah, I think that's that aspect as well.
Yeah, sometimes when if I watch a video of myself, like at a conference that's been recorded, I'm like, wow, I'm speaking so fast, you know. And also when I'm rehearsing at home, because I do rehearse my conference talks a lot, because I really want to feel like I know them, like, by heart when I go on stage, so I don't have to rely so much on speaker notes or these sorts of things. I can just kind of try to deliver as smooth of a presentation as I can. But usually when I record, I will have this feeling that, or not record, when I rehearse, when I rehearse, I feel like the talk feels much longer. But then when I actually go and deliver it on stage, it's usually actually shorter, like taking quicker time than I thought it would. So definitely, I'm also one of those people that speak way faster. I think it's also the adrenaline and the stuff when you're on stage in front of a live audience just makes you kind of, you know, go faster. But I do agree that the pacing of the videos is great. It's cool that you can customize it with the speed there, the playback speed. And also the fact that they have like really good summaries and chapters and transcription. Like, it just makes the videos a much, much more rich resource than they were before. Before, it always felt like when you had to go dig through like a WWDC video to find some information that you needed, it always took a little while and it was kind of hard to search and find things. Now, with a developer app or just on the web or whatever, and you're like looking through the transcript, you can like search through it and find exactly the chapter you need. If you want to just like go through a topic again, it's really great. So that part, I think, is a huge upgrade in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I was going to say that you kind of don't even have to watch the videos if you don't want to. I mean, you never had to, but it used to be the case that there would be incredibly valuable information that was just in WWDC session videos. And back in the day, those would be hours long sometimes. So having the entire content be multimedia and very dynamic, in the sense that you have synchronized transcripts, you have code snippets that you can search, you have summaries, you have all of that good stuff, to the point where watching the video is optional. I still like to watch them, at least the ones I'm for the things I'm most interested in. But you don't have to. And if you want to go back and reference something from the video, you no longer have to go searching for it in the video. You can use the code snippets or the transcript and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. And the way I like to watch the videos is that I usually start by picking the videos that I feel like are the most relevant to me. So that would be, for example, what's new in Swift or UIKit, Swift UI, and so on, like all the technologies that I use on a daily basis. And then I usually pick some that I'm just like interested in. That's usually something like GPU or metal related, because that's something that I'm like actively learning, and so on. Like, I pick like a little group of videos that I want to watch. And then I try to like watch them over like the first week or so, just to kind of, you know, get a feeling for what's new overall on Apple's platforms this year. And then I usually, when I'm watching the videos, I make notes of what I want to dive deeper into and what I want to try myself. Because one way that I've always been learning, at least like as a developer, is by doing, right? Like, I really need to like try these things out. And that's when I will go and look at the documentation and, you know, download Xcode beta and actually try things out myself. I've even started doing a thing where as early as possible, I migrate my client projects that I work on as a freelancer so that they work on the latest Xcode beta. I've already done that, actually. Because that way I also get a feel for what are the new kind of diagnostics that come into play and how do they affect a production app? Because that also gives me kind of more understanding for, you know, how these things work. And then, you know, I just tend to dive deeper and experiment and try things and do a lot of kind of projects over the summer, like small tests and things like that, just to get a feel for the features. And that way I feel like I can spread it out over time. I don't need to feel stressed that I need to learn everything in 1 week or something. I can do it over time. And I have this more kind of natural way of getting into things while still like always keeping up to date as a developer, because I do think that's very important. Like when you work on a specific platform, whether it's Apple's platforms or Android or .NET or whatever, to keep up to date with the platform so that you are always following kind of the latest best practices. And you know, if you discover or see some new language feature in an open source project, or maybe your coworker submits a pull request, you know what that is and you've seen it before and you can easily kind of refresh your memory as to, you know, what that is and how it works. So that's usually my approach.
Yeah, I think that's a good approach. And I think this year it wasn't too bad, right? At least with my projects, I don't think any of them would fail to build in Xcode 27. Got some warnings here and there and some deprecations and things like that. There's a thing in NapKit that got undeprecated, which is unprecedented, I think. Undeprecated and unprecedented. I can talk more about that later. But I didn't have any major issues.
So maybe we can use this as a way to segue into our first topic, which is what's new in Swift, or like new Swift features that were highlighted during WWDC. Because of course, Swift's release cycle is not 100% tied to Apple's kind of operating system release cycle, but the way most Swift developers interact with Swift is through Xcode. And when Xcode gets a version bump, that's when it gets a new Swift compiler, right? So that means that they are tied in quite a big way, at least like practically for most developers. And you mentioned there that, you know, most projects, they don't have so many problems like going from, for example, Swift 6.3 to Swift 6.4, which is what's in the beta of Xcode 27. A lot of numbers here to keep track of. The one thing that I noticed, which is not a hard error, it's a warning, which is a really nice warning, actually. And I'm happy they added this. It's a new diagnostic that's added when you have a task, so a Swift task, and you're throwing an error within a root task, and you're not handling that error. That now gives you a warning. And that, for me, was always kind of an interesting design decision that you're allowing top-level tasks to throw, because that is kind of, at least before this diagnostic, it is a very common source of programmer errors where you would just forget to handle a specific error, right? And then you have, you're basically silently failing and you can forget to update your UI or, you know, give the user feedback, or maybe another task that is depending on this one, or completion handler isn't called, or, you know, there are many different scenarios where that can become a problem if you're not handling the errors from your tasks, right? But now there's a warning for that. So if you are throwing an error or calling a try function, inside of a top-level task, you will get a warning that says that, you know, you should handle this error. And the kind of reason why tasks are able to throw is fundamentally because the way Swift's concurrency system handles cancellation is through errors. So when you do something like, you know, a basic example would be task.sleep, right? Like you're pausing a task for a certain time interval, you're calling that with try, because if the task gets canceled within that sleeping interval, that will bubble up a cancellation error to your task, and then you want your task to also be canceled, right? So now we can kind of have the best of both worlds. We can still have that system where we can use throwing tasks, and we can use errors for cancellation and so on, and we can also get a nice warning when we're accidentally not handling an error at a top level of a task. And it turned out that there were a few call sites where either I or a coworker had missed to do that, so could fix that now and get notified, which is really nice.
A related thing that is really useful for me, because it has bitten me a lot of times in the past, is let's say you have a scope where you have captured self. You did a weak capture of self. So you have to do self question mark or guard let self. Before, if you then captured self again inside of a, let's say, so you do a guard let self and then you capture self again in a task, that would not cause any warnings or errors because
right.
it didn't detect that. And now it gives you a warning, hey, you have captured self here, but you have not specified if it's weak or so. Because I've had situations in the past where it's very easy to forget that you are capturing self. And I think they were too lenient with how you're able to capture things in tasks. And now the diagnostics are a lot better to prevent retain cycles. I've had so many issues with retain cycles related to tasks in SwiftUI views that capture an observable object or something. And then
right.
you close a window and you look in the memory debugger and all of your objects are still there and you're wondering why. And then you find that one task that you didn't do the weak self dance.
Yeah, exactly. Because if you would capture, for example, in a closure, you capture self strongly, but then you do a weak self in a nested closure, well, self is still captured strongly in the root one, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, that's something to always keep in mind. Like, if you truly want a weak capture, you kind of need to do a weak capture at the root so that you know, going into that root closure, you have a weak self reference and then you can unwrap that at different points, depending on, you know, now I want to access self, or just do self question mark if you want it to be a no op if self is deallocated. So yeah, I also saw a few of those diagnostics as well. That's another really good addition. I think in general, like when the Swift compiler can be a little bit smarter and analyze your code a little bit more and give you those warnings when there's like a clear, maybe it's not clearly a bug, but at least it's a clear kind of anti-pattern, right? It's like something that you've written that is not clear. And I love when the compiler can warn you about things like that, because it also helps a team kind of, again, kind of move to those best practices, those modern best practices. And it also, like, very often can help you identify a bug or make you think twice about some code. Like, do I really need a strong self-capture here? Or actually, maybe I don't even need a weak self-capture here because there are no retain cycles taking place. So it just, you know, helps you go back and kind of rethink some of those assumptions that you might have made earlier.
Yeah. So lots of quality of life improvements related to concurrency this year, I think. You also have my favorite one, I think, which is the ability to do an asynchronous defer. So inside your defer block, you can now await if you are in an asynchronous context. That's a huge improvement. I need to go back in all of my code and find all the places where I have done all sorts of hacks to get around that before, and now I can just await inside a defer. That's magical.
Yeah, I'm really happy about that too. It's funny with defer, because the first time when it was introduced, which is quite a few many years ago now, when, you know, defer was added into the language, I think a lot of people, myself included, kind of looked at that and was like, why is this needed? I mean, can't we just run the thing at the end of the block, right? Like at the end of the scope?
So many bugs can be caused by
that. Exactly. You realize that it's really nice for functions where you have a lot of exit points, where you have either a lot of returns, like it can return at different points, or you can throw out of the function if you have some cleanup that needs to be done. And I would say increasingly with like Swift 6 and, you know, strict concurrency, if you have that enabled, you need to do a lot more async calls because you have different isolation and maybe you need to like do a cleanup on the main actor, but you are not on the main actor at the moment. So that's an await and so on. And like having defer be able to support that is really great because that means that you can put like your cleanup like in a defer block, then run all of your logic. And then that will always be run, even if now it's an async call at the end, like when the scope is exited, regardless of where it is. Like even if you throw out of the function, you will still run that defer block, which is really, really nice.
Yeah.
But I must say, like, again, so when I saw defer for the first time, I didn't really, you know what to do with it. And I started adopting it a little bit, but it was really when I started like learning a language called Zig, where I really started getting really, I really got the idea of defer and I really started like more like incorporating it into my, like the way I write my code. And it's because defer is really important in Zig because it you do manual memory management in there. And the pattern you often use is you allocate something and then right afterwards you put a defer statement to kind of deallocate it. And you often in Zig use something like arena allocators where you allocate a bunch of memory into an arena. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of your scope, you just deallocate that arena, right? So that way you can actually have manual memory management that is not that hard to reason about because you see both the allocation and the deallocation like right next to each other, right? Yeah. And I feel like the same thing is true even in Swift, which where we have automatic reference counting, where we can like allocate a resource. Let's say you open a database connection or some kind of resource or network call or something, and you store it in a let. And then you can right afterwards have defer, you know, clean up or remove temporary files. So whatever it might be. And that those two things are right next to each other. And I feel like from a readability perspective, that is actually a big win because it's, yeah, it's just easier to reason about when everything is just like in the same place.
Right. In a language like C, the way you typically do that is to have a label at the end and then you do like go to finish, is pretty much the pattern you end up using there. So this is a similar pattern. And I am the biggest fan of exit early. Like if you have nested if lets everywhere, stop doing that, please. If you can restructure your thing in a sense where you can use guard and then that's where the fur really shines because if you have a function that has lots of failure modes or places where it can lead somewhere else and you need to do some cleanup every single time, having that defer at the top and then guard everything at the bottom just makes the code read like it should, in my opinion, at least.
Yeah, and it also like you have to do less mental parsing of the code because you don't have to like go through and worry, am I really cleaning up everything here? Am I doing it in this branch or this branch? Especially if there are a lot of guards, like, do I need to do some cleanup here before I exit? Like if you do your any kind of like the cleanup that needs to happen regardless of how you exit in a defer, you can just forget about it. Like, you know that it's gonna be run.
Yeah, and it can get really confusing even for like seasoned developers. So I recently watched someone who was just starting to learn how to code. And one thing they struggled with a lot was managing brackets, basically. Because we don't think about that much, but it can be really confusing if you're not used to it. And if you haven't done, like, I guess, a lot of math notation and things like that, where you use parentheses and that sort of thing, it can get really confusing really quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those things that you get used to as a developer, you know, after a few years or so, like you kind of get used to seeing brackets and parentheses and square brackets for array literals and so on, right? But yeah, for a new developer, definitely I can imagine that it's something that takes a little while to get used to. And again, like, if you can make your code like easier to just parse mentally when you're reading it, like, because we do that so often, right? Like when we do code reviews on GitHub, like you're just reading the code, like you are the compiler, right? Like you are checking the code as a person. And if we can make the code easier to read in whatever way we can, I think that's just a big win.
Definitely.
All right. So continuing with interesting new Swift features in Swift 6.4, we have the diagnose attributes. Have you heard about this one, Rambo?
Yes. That was missing from the language very much.
Time to silence all the warnings easily in one annotation.
Yeah. Please use it sparingly, people.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the number one use case that I'm happy about here is deprecation warnings for things that you cannot adopt yet for whatever reason it is. Like most often the deprecation warnings are tied to your minimum deployment target. So you can just, you know, migrate to a new API when you bump your minimum deployment target. But sometimes it's not so simple. And sometimes there might be some platform bugs with like a new API that didn't exist with the old one. So you still need to use the old one for some reason. Or maybe you're just not ready to migrate yet because it's like it's a bigger is much bigger job, but you still want to do that minimum deployment target bump. So being able to like selectively, like again, like you said, using it sparingly, but selectively say, for this particular function, I want to treat deprecations, like I want to silence deprecation warnings or any other kind of way you want to change the diagnostics, that's the word. It's very useful. And I love that they built like a general purpose solution, that they didn't just do like at silence deprecations, right? That they built like a nice like attribute that you can use to customize all sorts of diagnostics. You can make them more severe, less severe. You can silence them. I think it's great. I think that's the kind of thing that when Swift does it like that, like in a more general purpose way, I think that's usually the way forward. Because one criticism of Swift that you can say is that there are so many kind of one-off solutions in the language. And part of it is also because Swift is very tied to Apple's platform. So you have like, you know, things like availability attributes for iOS specifically, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when you have some more general purpose solution like this that is not tied to just like one specific use case, I think that tends to stand the test of time better also.
Yeah, and one example, if folks are wondering, like in the VirtualBuddy project, there after I migrated to Xcode 27, only one warning remained, and that was about using the CG window list create image API, which has been deprecated for several years now. But that's basically you can take a snapshot image of a window on the system, and the app uses that because the helper that runs inside the virtual machine takes a screenshot of your wallpaper to use it as a thumbnail of the virtual machine. And you don't need screen recording permission, specifically if the only window you want to snapshot is the wallpaper window. There's that exception right in there. So this deprecated API is only used for that single purpose, but it is deprecated and has been for years, but it's the only API that allows you to do that. So I will be using this annotation so I can have a warning-free code base again.
Yeah, that's so nice. I always aim for that, to have a completely warning-free code base. Sometimes when I will, as a freelancer, like join a project and I see that, you know, the Xcode project has like 255 warnings or something, or sometimes even more, like one of the first thing I just ask the client is like, is it okay if I just spend a few hours just cleaning all of this up? Because, you know, the problem is when you have so many warnings, if there's a legitimate warning that is actually maybe going to cause a crash or something, you'll just miss it because it will just be one needle in the haystack, right?
Right. Yeah, and if you, especially with the new concurrency stuff, if you filter through those 200 warnings, you will find that probably like 60 are one thing and 80 are another thing. So it's something you can probably fix with a regular expression in find and replace and replace all, because it's typically just a missing annotation or things like that. If it's a project that hasn't done any work to adopt the new concurrency features.
Yeah, exactly. And speaking of, I just wanted to kind of wrap this up. So of course, there are more Swift features than we've covered here. And I definitely want to talk more about the new borrowing system, because it's also very interesting for me, also being a Rust developer these days, because Rust is very, very heavily based on the concept of borrowing. In fact, that's kind of how it's deals with things like memory safety and so on in a kind of different way than Swift does. But now Swift is also adopting some of those concepts with borrows and things like that for iterations and for non-copyable types and so on. But I feel like that kind of warrants its own topic. Or what do you think, Rambo?
Yeah, especially because I want you to explain it to me like I'm five.
Sure, I can do that. No problems. Wait until we get into lifetimes. That's going to be really fun. That's going to be a fun thing for me to explain. All right. So again, like many more interesting Swift features, we'll probably dive deeper into them on future episodes. But I just, before we segue into other kind of WWDC announcements or new features, I just wanted to take this moment. So we just talked about a whole bunch of new Swift features. But I feel like, you know, what I've been thinking a lot about, like, what's the current state of Swift 6 specifically? Because this is Swift 6.4, but a lot of projects still use Swift 5, but they're going to get these features, like, not all of the features, but a lot of the diagnostics and so on, and some of the language features as well, they still apply even when using Swift 5 mode, because you're using the Swift 6.4 compiler in Swift 5 legacy mode. And then you have, like, you can have strict concurrency on and off. You can have main actor by default on and off. Like, there are so many different variants and variations. And I feel like, Rambo, like, isn't this becoming a little bit of a mess?
Oh, it is. Very much so. They messed that up. I'm sorry, but the whole thing... It becomes a problem when, because let's say I ask someone about a problem I'm having with C code. In general, they are not going to need all of my compiler options to be able to help me. But with Swift, the matrix of possible combinations of different settings you can have is so large that... It becomes really hard. I know that there are some people who like post on Mastodon these like brain teasers about Swift concurrency and things like that, and like, hey, look at this code snippet. Is this going to compile without looking? And what is the diagnostic? And another person will ask, but is it in Swift 6 mode? And is it with strict concurrency on? And is it with main actor by default? So it's a lot of different compiler settings. I mean, it makes sense to have flexibility for developers, but it's not great. These days, I typically will use the Swift 6 language mode, but not with strict concurrency unless it's a low level framework or package that I'm building, but like for app targets or UI targets, I will not enable strict concurrency.
Yeah, I feel sort of the problem, core problem for me is that there's this Swift 5 and 6 mode, which are kind of not very clear when you can use features from Swift 6.4 when you're using Swift 5 mode, which kind of doesn't make any sense, right? So right. I feel like the way forward could possibly be to just say, get rid of that you're only using, you know, Swift the latest, Swift 6.4, for example, right now. But then you have these toggles like strict concurrency on off, main actor on off, which I feel like they should almost be like the same toggle, but just different levels, like because they are so related to each other. Like you could have, you know, no concurrency checking. I guess that's not, you know, a thing, but you could have something like that. Or I think there is a lowest level of the setting, but of course it will still do some checks because the minimal ones. Yeah, exactly. And then you could have like, oh, give me the minimum ones, but with main actor as default, and then give me, you know, the minimum ones without main actor as default, and then give me the strict ones or something like that. Because that would be a little bit easier to explain. It will turn this matrix into more like a list, you know, like more like a linear progression where you can, you know, you're always using the latest Swift that comes with Xcode. Like it used to be, but you can then escalate like your concurrency checking going from the lowest to the highest, almost like, you know, you're turning up the difficulty in a game, right? That could be easier to reason about, at least for me, but I feel like it's very counterintuitive that you can run in Swift 5 mode and still have features from Swift 6.4. But maybe I'm just being nitpicky about version numbers here, but at least that's how I feel about it.
I mean, it all works to say something good, and I do feel like it's getting better over time, not worse. So I hope we continue in this direction. I would maybe like to have seen this different Swift language modes at least be deprecated this year, because they haven't. So this means we are going to live with this for probably like the next 5 years at least, because if you deprecate it, you will, at the point where it's deprecated, it's probably still going to be supported for like the next two releases of Xcode or something. So yeah, it is a bit of a mess. And I do feel like the defaults in Xcode are good. If you make a new app target, it defaults to main actor and things like that. And I think, I'm pretty sure that Xcode 27 defaults to the Swift 6 language mode. I might be wrong there.
Oh, I haven't checked Xcode 27, but Xcode 26, the latest version, still defaults to Swift 5 mode with file new project.
Oh,
so I don't know about 27. We have to check that one.
Well, I'm creating a new project right now.
Okay, we're doing it live. Some live follow-up here.
Yeah.
Let's go. This is exciting. Live coding on a podcast without video.
By the way, huge quality of life improvement in Xcode. I love the new like throwaway projects you can make. Did you see that? Where you can basically create an untitled, unsaved project. And then when you save it, it converts it into a real Xcode project. I love that.
Oh, that's cool. I need to check that out. That sounds like perfect for me. Yeah, like I do throwaway projects all the time, like I talked about earlier. That's great. I'm definitely going to use that.
Yeah, it's really useful. And the default is Swift 5.
There you go. Yeah, and it feels wrong, right, to be like so many years after the release of Swift 6. We're on Swift 6.4, but the default is still Swift 5. And, you know, I, again, work as a freelancer, so I see many different projects like on a weekly basis, and I sometimes get asked to help teams with code reviews, and I do workshops and so on. So I see a lot of code bases, and I can tell you that there's a lot of teams out there still using Swift 5 because the I feel like the motivation for a lot of developers to upgrade when the first thing that happens when you enable the Swift 6 toggle, even with some of those like convenience features enabled, is still like hundreds of compiler errors in a larger project. It's like it's hard for teams I found to prioritize that or to like find the time or the motivation to actually go through and do that upgrade. In fact, I was earlier today doing some Swift 6 migration for a client. So yeah, it's still happening like so many years later. And that's, I think, why it's still the default. And it just kind of shows you that it is a bit of a mess, even though, you know, I still think, you know, the language features that are being added are great. I think overall the concurrency system is pretty great, but it's just asking a lot from you when it comes to correctness, especially if you haven't like written like guaranteed thread safe code up until this point, which very few people have, because, you know, we've used things like non-final classes that we pass around between threads and stuff, which is not allowed anymore. So yeah, it is a really complex situation. I really don't like have a good answer for how to fix it, but it's, I guess, like deprecating Swift 5 formally will at least give like companies or the management, you know, a bit of a, let's say, a motivation to to prioritize that migration. But yeah, it's also, I'm sure if they do that, they're going to hear a lot of complaints from developers who might not, you know, either have the time or have too large of a code bases that are really difficult to migrate to Swift 6. And yeah, it is not an easy situation.
I do think the new defaults since last year, which is main actor by default, that kind of solves the problem in a sense for most people, because if you're just a developer creating a new app, you don't have to think about concurrency much unless you're actually using it. Because the problem before was that even if you're not doing anything with concurrency, it was getting in the way of you doing your work, basically, even if you're not actually doing anything concurrently. So having main actor by default and then having concurrency be the exception, not the norm, I think is the best approach for most folks. And I will say, though, I in this throwaway project here, I have changed the Swift language mode to 6. And I noticed that apparently the default strict concurrency checking version when you change the language mode to 6 is complete and not minimal, which is interesting. And the sample project still builds without errors or warnings, which was not the case in previous years. So that's good as well.
That's an improvement.
Yeah.
The sample project compiles. Hooray.
Yeah, I think the big problem before was also that a lot of system API just did not have any annotations for Swift concurrency.
That's still the case, though.
Yeah, but it has been getting better, though.
Yeah, but I think really that is also a big part of the problem. There's still a lot of workarounds that you have to do, even when you're using an API, quote unquote, correctly, just because the correct annotations are not in place yet. So it has definitely gotten better. But yeah, I still feel like there's a lot of like fundamental work to be done here to kind of, you know, really help the community kind of overall go over to Swift 6 completely, so that we can have that standard where it's like when you're joining a team, for example, you can kind of count on, okay, this project is going to be using Swift 6 or like the latest version, or the maybe not the latest, but the current kind of stable Xcode version. Because that always used to be the case, and it just simplifies also for all developers, like to know that we have that shared foundation in Swift that is, you know, kind of something you can rely on, instead of it being so complex and so many different variations of just the language and the compiler.
Right. And I also wish we could have default actor isolations per file. Like, let's say I have a project that has main actor by default, or a target, and in one specific file, let's say like I have a file with all of my models, I don't want my models to be isolated to the main actor. They are all like structs with just normal Swift types inside of them. I would like to be able to say, oh, here's my model file. This one is non-isolated. Otherwise, you have to place non-isolated in front of every single type declaration and extension. And I think there's a proposal for that, or it was part of the proposal that introduced this default actor isolation, but I don't think it's implemented.
Right. Yeah, I am still not 100% convinced about this main actor by default thing. Like, I feel like it's a little bit of a too broad thing to apply to a project, to say like the default thing is for all code to run on the main thread or the main actor, unless you like have a separate actor or you make it non-isolated.
It is per target though. So
right.
You can... and also, we have been using main actor as the example, but it doesn't have to be main actor, right? It can be any global actor or non-isolated.
Right. Yeah, that's true. That's true. But perhaps that's also a topic for a future episode to dive deeper into all of that. But anyway, I just, you know, it's interesting to reflect when we have a new Swift version of like, what's the current state of Swift, which overall I think is a really good one. I think Swift is doing great, and it's really cool to see also it expanding more to other platforms, you know, as a kind of first class targets, and Swift becoming truly more of a, like a cross-platform project. That's fantastic to see. So I really am enthusiastic about Swift, and I think, you know, the state is overall pretty good. It's just like, you know, it would be nice for it to be simplified like we just talked about, and I'm sure it's a very, very complex, and it's hard to manage like this kind of complex language in this way. So yeah, let's just hope it gets better in the future. But Rambo, you have a fun grab bag for us here, I've heard. Like some fun new features that were introduced in WWDC that you want to talk about. So why don't you take it away?
So the first one is not really a feature necessarily, but it's a very interesting presentation, which... You mentioned the talks you always like to watch at WWDC, and at least in my case, I do like to start out with the what's new in whatever sessions, which are like, what's new in Swift? What's new in Swift UI? What's new in Swift data? What's new in foundation models? And one such talk is what's new in AppKit. And I think we need to take this opportunity, because not that many podcasts are talking about AppKit these days. Maybe ATP also talks about AppKit every now and then. But the AppKit session was very interesting, John. And it was very interesting because they spent a significant amount of time talking about how you should change the APIs you're using for event handling. So instead of, say, overriding mouse down on a view, you should use gesture recognizers. And the reason why, John, is because apparently, for some reason this year, Apple has decided that it's very important that every single thing in macOS works really well with touch screens for when people are using Sidecar on their iPad. That's the reason.
Of course. Of course. Like, famously, the way to use a Mac is to use Sidecar with your iPad. Everybody does it, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's very interesting. So basically, and it's interesting because I do have one app where I do a lot of event handling, which is my core animation editor, but it's an app that it's just for me. I don't ship it, so I'm the only user, and I don't really use Sidecar that much. and thinking about having to, because it has a canvas, and canvases are very complicated UI to implement. And the event handling I've built in there is quite tricky to get right. And I definitely do not envy the folks who are going to have to rewrite their canvas implementation in their photo editing app or something to support touchscreen Macs when those eventually come. So yeah, it's gonna be rough for those folks.
Yeah, especially since it's a very different programming model, like when you will override like mouse down, for example, on a view controller compared to implementing a gesture recognizer and adding that to the view hierarchy. Like you go from like responding through a method override to basically a closure, or you can do also a selector-based API, right? Mm-hmm. Those kinds of migrations tend sometimes to be a little bit tricky, especially if you have like a class hierarchy where you're overriding like in different subclasses the mouse down event to perform mm-hmm. that specific handling for that subview, which is a very, very common pattern on AppKit, right? Especially with the whole like event handling system and with the responder chain and so on. Like that's imagine that that's going to take quite a lot of work to perform that migration for different teams.
Yeah, and in my case, that internal app that I have, I've implemented everything in terms of tools. So I have like a base tool class, like an abstract tool class, which has all of the override points and provides base event handling functionality. And the canvas view defers or delegates to the currently selected tool, so the tool that the user is using, and the user in this case is myself. So you have like the gradient tool, if you are editing a gradient layer, so then you can drag the gradient stops and things like that. So that's a different tool implementation, and all of them use a shared event handling implementation, which I guess is helpful if I do decide to migrate to gesture recognizers, because I will, in theory, only have to migrate in one place. But the way you typically do that in AppKit, the way you did it before they introduced gesture recognizers, which I don't think many Mac apps actually use, to be honest, is on mouse down, you are not going to override the mouse dragged event in a view. You are going to, on mouse down, dispatch an event tracking loop. So you basically enter an infinite loop of some sort when mouse down starts, and then you manually stop that event handling loop. And this is important because in AppKit, I don't think this is important in iOS, but on the Mac, your app can, the main run loop can be in different modes. And there's like the regular mode where it's just running your app, but there's also the event tracking mode. So you will notice this if you, let's say you hit Command B in Xcode and the progress bar starts moving. If you click one of the menus, the progress bar stops moving because the app has entered an event tracking loop, basically, for the menu. So that's what most apps do for this sort of interaction on the Mac. And in my app specifically, my document model has a thing where it can observe when the app enters and exits an event tracking loop so that it can coalesce undo events in that period. Let's say I drag a layer from 0 to 500. I don't want 500 undo events. Like I will be Command Z, Command Z, Command Z. Because the way my app works is every single edit generates an undo event. But because I have the benefit of the whole event tracking loop and things like that, I can have the document be smart in a sense and coalesce those changes that happen in between event tracking start and end. So I don't know if gesture recognizers do the same thing under the hood. So it would probably be very difficult in my case to migrate to that. I'm glad it's just an internal app that I'm not shipping. But for folks who do have those sorts of apps, it's going to be a lot of work.
I guess with gesture recognizers, you could always become the delegate and you could check like what's the state of it. And when it starts, you can start your quote unquote event tracking loop. Like you can write some of that logic yourself, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when it changed, you don't store any undo snapshots. And then when you finished, that's when you will like end that event tracking loop. So if it doesn't do it out of the box, I'm guessing that's something that can be implemented, you know, without like rewriting the whole thing or, you know, changing everything about how you do undo events.
Right. And if you didn't catch it, our dear listener, what Apple is basically saying in this session for AppKit is we're going to have Macs with touchscreens, and the way you test it is by using Sidecar on iPad. That's the message that they did not say, but it's the message they want to send along.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the classic example of when they introduced size classes and auto layout things and all those things. Like, in case your UI changes size while it's running, you know, like, and things like that, that I was clearly, you know, laying the groundwork both for larger iPhones and then later also the multi-tasking things for iPad and so on when, you know, a window can change size. So yeah, it's as clear of a message as we're going to get from Apple that a new product is coming.
And also this year they have resizable simulators and even real device windows that you can resize and see what your app looks like in a very interesting aspect ratio that kind of matches what, let's say, a foldable iPhone would have.
Yeah, exactly. Like an iPhone that changes size. What could that be? Yeah, this is exciting.
Yeah, definitely. And also lots of built-in apps that did not support landscape mode before suddenly do. I wonder why as well.
Yeah, exactly. Finally catching up on, you know, iPhone OS 2.0, which supported landscape orientation.
And finally, I would like to talk just a little bit about the Foundation Models API, because it is very ergonomic. I don't know if you have played around with it last year, but I really like the way they handled implementing a declarative API for interacting with language models. And this year they went all in, and it's kind of like SwiftUI, John.
Yeah, so what do you think about that? So there's this aspect of, you know, a lot of modern Apple APIs, they're using result builders, you know, which is what you're referring to, right? When you are writing a declarative implementation using like a closure-based scope, and then you're saying like, here's one component, here's another one. You can put if statements in there, but you're not returning values. You're just kind of declaring them within a scope. And it feels like, you know, this is another instance of where, you know, if everything you have is a result builder, everything looks like a result builder shape problem, right? Like it. So how do you feel about this? It sounds like you like it.
Yeah, I do. I found it a little bit funny when I first saw it in the presentation. But after actually using it, and there is a Mastodon post where I show a little experiment I did, I think that's it, John. I think that's the not the right approach, because there are other approaches that would work as well. But I do think it lends itself really well to the problem space, where when you're using language models, you are typically experimenting a lot and changing parameters and tweaking things. And I think a declarative way of doing that is a good approach, because otherwise you end up with a lot of boilerplate code everywhere. Or you would have to, I don't know, have a JSON file or a property list or something where you have your different prompts and your different configurations. And I especially like that you can have a dynamic profile, it's what they're calling it. So you can think of a dynamic profile as, it's kind of like a SwiftUI view, but for language models. So you have a body, and in there, you can have this dynamic profile can have a property that's an at observable. So you have like a controller or something. So in the body, you can completely change the configuration of your language session based on the current state of your world, basically, in your app. So this really works well for creating these agentic apps where you're not just asking a question to the model and getting a response. You're actually doing a kind of a loop with the model and having it call different tools to do different tasks. So inside of that implementation, you can change the tools that are available to the model. You can change the model itself. You can change parameters of the model, such as temperature. You can change prompts, of course. You can have modifiers that you can use to automatically compact the conversation context without, and you can do it losslessly or in a lossy way. So you can have a modifier that compacts the context only for one specific task in one specific pass of your language session. But the session itself retains the entire history. So I think it's very powerful. And after playing around with it, I really like this approach. And also, they are going to be open sourcing the Foundation Models framework. So you will be able to use it on your server if you want to on Linux. And also, you can now use third-party models. And I've been mostly playing around with Anthropic's Swift package because I had some Claude API credits in my account. So I've been playing around with that. And it works just the same as if you're using Apple's own models. And it's just a matter of doing like a modifier and instantiating one of the Anthropic models. Of course, then you have to manage API keys and things like that, but you can also proxy through one of your servers. But yeah, in general, I think this is a good approach, and I've been enjoying it so far.
Yeah, it sounds really awesome. I need to try it out more myself also. It sounds really, really good. And I do agree that, you know, you mentioned there that in another world, this could have been like a JSON file API instead, right? Where you have like your configuration file as a JSON or YAML or something like that. But having it all in Swift code and having it still have that kind of manifest-like structure like a JSON file would have, it works really well for problems like this. And also that, you know, I feel like result builders have sort of become like a standard for building-based APIs, where previously we would implement some kind of builder API, perhaps, or some kind of, you know, you would have like a NS mutable array that you would then turn into an array or something like that. You would mutate some object and then copy it into an immutable version. But this just kind of standardizes all of that and says like, okay, here's the approach we can take. We can implement a result builder. We can override or implement these certain functions for building different kinds of blocks, like if statements and so on, if lets and loops and so on. And then, you know, you have this shared language that Swift UI and foundation models and lots of other APIs, widgets can use. And I think that's really powerful because it becomes more than, you know, this kind of learn once, use everywhere, not just like in terms of, oh, I can now learn how to build UIs for both iOS or macOS or tvOS or whatever. I can also now like understand other domains that follow the same API structure, which I think is really, really powerful when you have that kind of normalization of how the API works.
By the way, one thing I found LLMs are particularly good at is taking an API that is not declarative and making a result builder's implementation of that API. So if you have some API that you think could benefit from having a declarative version using result builders, ask Codex or Claude or whatever. I've had some good experiences with that.
Yeah, and at first it might seem like implementing your own result builder, like in an app, for example, is like over-engineering, like you're trying to build some kind of general purpose UI framework or something. But again, it's like for that shape of that problem, like this kind of building thing that you might have implemented like a builder or something for before, it's really not that much code these days to implement a result builder to get something basic going, and it can be really, really powerful. In fact, in almost every app that I work on, there are some result builders, custom result builders for things like, you know, toolbar items, for example, toolbar buttons that I want to have like specific, like declarative placements for and not just use the SwiftUI API directly because I want to be able to control the order and the prioritization of where each item gets placed and so on. can write a result builder for that. Then you have that same nice declarative API with Swift UI, but for your own kind of UI logic. And, you know, all sorts of things like that. It's really, really a powerful tool.
I wrote one for core animation, of course.
Oh, right. Of course. Yeah. Yeah, so that's really
whole,
awesome.
Like layer hierarchy using a declarative API. And there's also one for animations. You can create a whole timeline of CA animations using a declarative API, which I really like.
Yeah, same. And of course, I wrote Plot, which is for HTML, like result builders for HTML with Swift.
Very good.
So, yeah, it's like it's really good for that kind of problem when you're building any kind of hierarchy or like manifest or something. Like, yeah, result builders are pretty great. I just hope that Apple doesn't go too overboard with them and it's like result builders everywhere. But so far I think it's all good.
Result builder, all the things.
Exactly. So before we wrap up here today, Rambo, were there some other things that you wanted to highlight from your initial WWDC impressions? I'm sure we'll talk a lot more about these announcements over the last months or so. But were there any other kind of things you want to mention here before we wrap up?
Minor thing, but that I thought is interesting is, did you hear that the at state property wrapper in Swift UI is no longer a property wrapper?
I did see that, and it's pretty cool because macros and property wrappers use the same syntax, right? So you can kind of migrate without requiring any call sites to be updated. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and it solves a long-standing problem with at state, which is when you want to be able to initialize a state property of your view with something that comes from outside of your view. So that has typically been an issue where you would maybe have your at state var declaration property have an initializer, and then you initialize it in your view's init as well, and then you end up initializing the same thing twice, and the new macro fixes that, basically.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's really good. And also, like, when you have when you're using it for classes now, where we before would use state object, it also prevents like additional initializations and additional like allocations that are just thrown away when the same view is refreshed, when the parent view body is evaluated.
Yeah, so that's a quality of life improvement. I do wonder if it's still using Combine under the hood. I don't think so, right? Or maybe it is. I don't know.
Has it all been migrated now to the new observable?
Yeah, it used to be really tied to Combine, right? I think both SwiftUI and Combine came out the same year, and they had this really tight coupling in a sense, but I think that's been dying out over the years.
Yeah, I think in general, if you expand the macro, for example, for observable, that is not using Combine at all. It's just like, managing your observers, with an array and so on. It's only when you use at published where you're actually creating a Combine publisher. So I don't think state binding and so on uses Combine, but it's possible it still uses somewhere under the hood, but I don't think so. I think it's all Swift code. Like, I'm guessing now that most of it is generated by the macro, but I need to look into that a bit more.
Right. And of course it can be a pain. Like in my case, for example, AirBuddy has a lot of Combine in there because you was built in the era where Combine was the thing. And then actually I have an observation system I wrote myself for when the app supported OS versions before Combine. So what I did is a lot of really core things in my app use that thing that I wrote myself. But then I wanted to use that with Swift UI. So I wrote a converter that turns that my observable thing into a Combine thing so that I can use it in Swift UI. But then, of course, came async sequence. So I made also a thing that takes my thing and makes it into an async sequence. So at some point, I will probably have five different incarnations of this old observation thing I wrote myself that probably has bugs that I don't know about, I guess. it's working. Don't touch it.
But I do really love that in general these days, like when a new API or paradigm or something like Async 08 is introduced, like you always have some kind of compatibility story. Like, for example, it's built in that you can take a combined publisher and access its values as an async sequence. And you can use like with checked continuation, for example, to bridge a completion handler or maybe futures and promises based API to Async 08 and kind of gradually migrate. In fact, like most projects that are a little bit older that I work on, they have all sorts of like async abstractions kind of under the hood. But then usually, you know, we try to build some kind of layer that we say, okay, here is like from here on and upwards is Async 08. But of course, if you have a really complex like database model and so on that you've been shipping in production for years and years, that's not necessarily something you want to just go and rewrite. So, you know, the fact that we can keep these things compatible, even like going back to say, you know, have an Objective-C based API that is using closures from like 15 years ago, and it's now using Async 08. And it's actually also like now adopting like some Swift concurrency things, and you're adding that on top, and it can all kind of work. I think it's pretty incredible, actually.
Yeah, definitely. And in my case, the most complicated part would be the entire preferences system in AirBuddy, which is quite complex because there are things that are stored in standard user defaults, there are things that are stored in the app group defaults, and there are things that are stored in ubiquitous key value store for iCloud. And I have a property wrapper basically that you use to declare those types of storage mechanisms, and like I want this particular value to be stored in this place and what the default is and things like that. And that is built on top of my custom observation thing, and it handles things such as keeping updates synchronized between multiple processes, which is something that I don't look forward to rewriting anytime soon, because it was quite complicated when I first wrote it. I mean, it was several years ago, so maybe I'm a better developer now, but... Again, it's working just fine.
It sounds like something you should migrate to Result Builders, Rambo.
Oh, no.
And on that note, let's go ahead and wrap up this episode here. So like I mentioned, we'll definitely dive deeper into a lot of these topics on future episodes. And if you have any specific like WWDC announcements or Swift features or anything like that you would like us to talk about on the show, please reach out via either Mastodon or Blue Sky or email. Links will be in the show notes for all of those things. But until then, thanks a lot for listening, and say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.